Most of us don't grow our own food these days. A few generations ago, we might have done just that, and we might have made our own beer or wine, too. Now, that still happens. In fact, we'll ask our guests if more people are home brewing these days. We'll spend the hour talking about beer made at home and beer made professionally with reps from both ventures. They do get together and talk shop from time to time, like at a rally planned for this Sunday at Standing Stone Brewing in Ashland. That's where Larry Chase is the brewmaster. He's the guest in the studio here. Hi, Larry.
Good morning.
And we also have with us on the phone Gary Glass, who is the director of the American Home Brewers Association with the great acronym of AHA. Hi, Gary.
Hi. Great to be with you.
Let's start with you. Tell us a bit about the American Home Brewers Association, what it's about, and how long it's been around.
Sure. Yeah, we've been around since 1978. We currently have around 45,000 members nationwide and actually internationally. And we're about promoting homebrewing and helping homebrewers make the best beer in the world.
What kinds of assistance can you give to homebrewers?
Well, we provide a lot of information, both on our website, homebrewersassociation.org, and through our magazine, which goes to members, called Zymergy Magazine, which means the fermentation or the science of fermentation. And then we also put on our National Homebrewers Conference. We're expecting about 4,000 people to that in San Diego coming up. And then, you know, we also put on events around the country, and one of those events is this AHA rally that we've got coming up.
And what happens at the rallies?
They're really excellent gatherings of homebrewers at a local brewery. Just about everybody who gets started as a commercial brewery, started out as a homebrewer. And I think, you know, Larry might be an exception to that rule. I think I've talked to him about that, but so it's really a bunch of people who are very much like-minded, who are part of the same community, getting together at a brewery, able to talk about their homebrewing, get VIP tours of the brewery, samples of the brewery's beer, meet fellow homebrewers, and learn a little bit more about their hobby.
And what was that word again? Zymergy?
Zymergy, yes. It's the science of fermentation.
Does that make you a zymergologist, Larry Chase?
Sure. Yeah.
Let's talk about how.
Although I've never been called that before.
let this be the first. Let's talk about the process of becoming a professional brewer then. I mean, did you not come in through home brewing as Gary just alluded?
Gary is right. I'm probably one of the rare exceptions that did not homebrew. Now, I had picked up The Joy of Homebrewing, written by Charlie Papazian, which is sometimes considered the homebrewer's Bible. And that is where I got my first interest in understanding of the brewing process. Yet at the time, I was working four jobs trying to make money to go travel, and I didn't have the time to homebrew.
And I'm curious, I'll ask this first. It was the kind of thing I could have waited till the end to ask, too. But do you actually homebrew now, or is it the kind of thing where you don't want to go home and do the thing you do at work, did at work all day?
You're exactly right. The job of brewing on the scale that we do it involves a lot of cleaning. And I clean all day at work. Why do I want to do it when I go home at night?
So how long does it take to make a good zymergologist? No, to make a good brewmaster. I mean, how long does it take to work your way up and know the process well enough to feel confident in it?
First of all, getting the mechanics down of how to operate a brew house happens fairly quickly. I mean, 3, 4, 5 months, you can become confident in doing that. It's the ins and outs and understanding all the intricacies and details, the science, that frankly, after 17 years, I'm still learning and still trying to improve on what I do. So I think that there's multiple ways to go about doing it. Learning on the job is by far one of the best avenues. Anywhere today, though, is you probably need to have some education, some college coursework in the sciences, and there are definitely a lot of brewing schools out there available now that delve more deeply into the science of brewing, and that's important stuff to know and have if you're going to make a career of it.
It's not terribly surprising given the proliferation of local brewing operations like Standing Stones.
Sure.
And so, Gary Glass, I want to ask you, though, about connecting homebrewers and pros, because was this a bit of an uneasy alliance at first, given that I can see where a guy running a brewery might think, well, why do I want to show these guys how to make stuff so they won't drink it at my bar anymore?
No, it's actually really been, and it's probably fairly unique situation, in that the homebrewing community is the leading advocates for their local breweries, because they understand the process. They love the fact that there's a brewery in their community. They're the ones that are going to be bringing their friends and family to the local brewery and open, you know, introducing them to local craft beers. So it really isn't. We really haven't had any conflicts between professionals and amateurs. It's like I said before. It's really they're all part of the same brewing community.
And what are the questions they tend to ask most often? Do you talk to a lot of homebrewers at this point already, Larry Chase?
Oh yeah, definitely. And one of the great things about giving homebrewers tours of the brewery is that they've already got a basic understanding of what's going on. And so you can dive a little more deeply into the nitty-gritty details. And they've always got great questions, because one thing about the brewing community as a whole is there's a lot of camaraderie and there's a lot of desire to share knowledge and to share information. And that is a great thing that we can do as professionals to help out homebrewers and give them pieces of advice that can help improve the skill that they're attempting at home.
We have so many more questions about the whole process of brewing beer, both at home and at the professional level. We're talking to Larry Chase, who's the brewmaster at Standing Stone Brewing Company in Ashland. Gary Glass is on the phone with us. He's the director of the American Homebrewers Association, AHA. Welcome back and talk to the two of them and take your phone calls and emails about the brewing process and what it takes to make decent beer. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Back with our guests, talk of beer and you in a minute. At 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about brewing beer on the Exchange today with a couple of guests who know the process both from the professional and from the amateur levels. Larry Chase is in the studio with me. He is the brewmaster at Standing Stone Brewing Company in Ashland, a well-known regional brewery operation and restaurant. And Gary Glass is on the phone with us from Colorado. He's the director of the American Home Brewers Association. You may have lots of questions about some of the basic steps to get involved in brewing beer. Join us at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Gary, just because I'm curious, would you tell us, is the directorship of the AHA a full-time job?
Yeah. For sure.
but was there something else? Was there another career you had before getting into this position?
Well, I actually got started with the American Homebrewers Association 15 years ago. Started out as the administrator for the basically doing whatever the director didn't want to do, and I've worked my way up since. At the time, I was working on a degree for graduate school and didn't foresee it as being a career move, but it certainly worked out that way.
Okay, I was just curious to know if you came at it from a professional brewing thing yourself, but it sounds like not.
No, I had been homebrewing for quite a while when I got started with the AHA, but never brewed professionally.
I'm curious at the professional level, which Larry Chase operates at Standing Stone. First of all, how big a set of batches do you make there? I mean, the tanks are right there in the restaurant with the folks, but is that the whole operation of the brewing right there?
It is. Yeah, mm-hmm. We make about 300 gallons at a time, the equivalent of about 10 barrels of beer.
Mm-hmm. And how many different varieties can you make at one time?
That really depends on the number of fermenters you have. We have four active fermenters at Standing Stone, so we can have four different beers in active process at any given time.
And so tell us about the process then, because just walk us through from square one. What are some of the first things you're going to need just to get started making beer?
Sure. Well, first of all, you need ingredients. There's four primary ingredients in beer. One is malted barley. Another is water. And you're going to take those two ingredients and you're going to mix them. It's going to be hot water. So you get this big vessel that looks like a big bowl of oatmeal. We call it the mash. And the whole purpose of that is to extract sugar out of that malted barley. From there, what we've created now, this very sweet liquid, we call it wort, W-O-R-T. It's a fabulous German word. I've looked up a little bit of the etymology of that, and a rough translation is that it's the root of something. So you can you could consider wort to be the root of beer.
I'm glad to hear it's not pronounced wort, because when I saw that there was a wort giveaway at this rally on Sunday, I thought, not good. It does not sound good. Okay, so wort, you get the malted barley and water together.
Right, so then we're going to take all that wort and we're going to boil it. During the boil, we add our third ingredient, which is hops. And if you're in Oregon driving through the Willamette Valley, it's the second largest commercial producer of hops here in the state of Oregon. And hops is a flower. Grows on a vine that gets 18 to 20 feet tall in the field. What hops are going to provide are a couple different things. There's a bunch of acids in hops that provide bitterness to beer. It's a nice counterbalance to that sugar sweetness you get from the malt. And then the hops also have a lot of oils, and those oils are going to provide aromas and flavors to the beer as well. And so you're adding your hops then during that boiling process.
All right, so you got malted barley, water, and hops thus far. Is there a fourth ingredient?
You got it, yeah. Last one is really the workhorse, probably the what we consider the real employees of the brewery. That's the yeast. So we're going to take all this freshly boiled hopped wort, and we're going to pitch yeast into it and let the magic happen. The yeast goes to work and turns all those sugars through the process of fermentation into alcohol and carbon dioxide, along with hundreds of other byproducts that certainly provide flavor to beer. And after we make primarily ales at Standing Stone, which means we're using a yeast that ferments at warmer temperatures in the mid 60 to low 70 degree Fahrenheit range. And so after about 4 days, we've got beer.
And I want to turn to Gary Glass now at the American Home Brewers Association. Same general run of ingredients, I would believe. But what kinds of hardware do you need to get started?
It is the same ingredients, but as a home brewer, you can skip the whole mashing step by using an extract. So it's a little bit simpler for people who are getting into the hobby. Although you can certainly do the full all grain. Version of brewing at home as well, but that it's a little bit more involved. The equipment you need is fairly simple. A basic beginner kit for home brewing is going to run around $80 to $120, and that's going to include a fermenter. Usually, people getting started will use a plastic bucket and some tubing, something to cap their bottles with. It's fairly simple and relatively inexpensive. You're going to need a kettle to boil in, usually something that's going to be around 5 gallons for extract batches or a little bit bigger if you're doing all grain. But that's the primary equipment that you need.
And about how much room are you going to need in your house? I mean, if you have a garage, it sounds like this is a good place to do this. If you do it in the bathroom, you're probably going to get another member of the family annoyed.
When I got started, everything I used fit into a closet, so I didn't anger my roommates too much. Plus, the end product is beer, so
your roommates won't like that part of it. Yeah.
as long as the people you live with actually like beer, then usually it's not an issue.
I think a lot of homebrewers use their stove to do the boil.
Yeah,
right in the kitchen.
Yeah.
So do you need a specialized kettle for this? I mean, do you need any kind of a pressurized device or something like that?
No pressure's involved. Just a regular, kind of a stock pot will work just fine.
For the home brewers, are there limits to how big a batch you can make and how you can make it? Are you doing all your, is all your aging happening in bottles? Is it happening somewhere else?
Usually fermentation takes place in either plastic bucket or a glass or plastic carboy, which is just a big jug. Most homebrewers are brewing 5 gallon batches. Now there are equipment kits available for 1 gallon, which makes it super simple. And then there are homebrewers who are brewing larger batches, up to 10, 15, 20 gallons. But most homebrewers are brewing 5-gallon batches.
Right. Just in terms of the basic science, Larry Chase, it seems like there are enough variables here, although 4 basic ingredients, but enough variables in things like temperature and amount and stuff that you could get a very, very different batch of stuff depending on what temperatures you achieved, slight variations in the amounts of the ingredients, stuff like that. How sensitive is the process to those kinds of changes?
The process can be sensitive. One of the great things about brewing, though, is that it can be so simple that you can do it at home on your stove, or you can make it so complex to try to control as many of those variables as possible that you end up having breweries that operate as big as factories and get very detailed about that. So when it comes to consistency, that's what commercial professional brewers are definitely concerned with in terms of controlling a lot of those variables. At the homebrew level, though, my guess consists, I've never homebrewed, but my guess is consistency is not the biggest issue. You're really just having fun experimenting and producing your own beer. And since you don't have to sell it as a homebrewer, consistency is not nearly as important as it is for us in the commercial world, where customers come in and they want the same beer that they had 4 weeks ago when they walked in the door.
You do not get to play mad scientist at Standing Stone, do you?
Right. We can play mad scientist in terms of recipe development for new varieties, new batches that we're going to put out, but not within the same brand that we're making.
So when you do start, I mean, if you haven't offered something before, do you give yourself a little leeway there in slow season perhaps to use some available equipment to make a new batch of something that you think might taste okay?
So for us at Standing Stone, most of my experiments for new recipes are going to be anywhere in that 6 to 10 barrel size. We don't have a smaller system that we play around with. I often compare it, though, to a cook or a chef who really understands ingredients and understands process. You can write a recipe and have a fairly good idea of what it is that's going to come out at the end. And for the most part, as long as you're maintaining a very clean and sanitary brewery, you're going to produce a beer that is very drinkable. Now, as brewers, we're always our own worst critics. And so while the batch may come out and it's certainly sellable and drinkable and people enjoy it, we probably would want to tweak it. And for specialty beers that we do, yeah, it might be another year before we make that beer again. But we'll have taken notes and we'll make some tweaks here and there as in constantly trying to improve it.
It's a science segment today. We're talking about the science of making beer with Larry Chase, who's the Standing Stone Brewing Company in Ashland, brewmaster. Gary Glass on the phone is the director of the American Home Brewers Association. Home brewers and professional brewers get together this weekend at Standing Stone in Ashland with a rally on February 22nd, which is Sunday, isn't it?
Sunday, yes.
Okay, 2 to 5 p.m., I see. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760. Maybe you're thinking about getting into the homebrew operation. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange with your questions. Again, 800-838-3760 around the listening area. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We have a question here from Jay in Walterville. He says, a lot of apples go to waste in the Pacific Northwest. Some people glean and harvest. I mean, how would you carbonate hard cider? Does either of you have any knowledge of that process?
Well, we don't make hard cider ourselves because we're licensed to only produce malt beverages. In terms of carbonating cider, if you're doing it on a small scale at home, and Gary will probably have a better idea of this, but once you get your fermentation going, you want to get that into a bottle and have a short amount of sugar remaining so that once you cap that bottle, you're able to naturally carbonate the beer, or I guess it'd be the cider mm-hmm. in this case.
Sure, yeah, with either cider or beer, in order to get carbonation, you can add a little bit of sugar. If you're making a hard cider, you would ferment the cider first, the apple juice fermented, and then when you're ready to bottle it, you add a little bit of a sugar, or you could add some additional apple juice preferably fairly carefully measured, and then mix that in and then put it into the bottles, and they'll still be yeast as long as you're not filtering out the yeast. There'll still be yeast in the cider or beer when you bottle it, and that yeast will consume that remaining sugar and produce carbon dioxide in the bottles.
We've certainly talked to enough people who have been major proponents of fermented foods on the Jefferson Exchange that there's a lot of fascination there, and I wonder if that extends out from the process of making beer. Gary Glass, do you find that people who've gotten into making beer also decide they want to ferment some other things as well?
Oh, sure. Yeah, making cider is quite popular with homebrewers, as is making mead, which is honey wine, certainly making grape wine. But I've also seen people starting to get into, kombucha. I personally have made sauerkraut. All kinds of fermentation going on. Once you get into that first level, it's pretty easy to translate from one type of fermentation to another.
It seems like wine has been on uptick for several years, particularly in the Rogue Valley of Oregon, where we're broadcasting from. Lots more people getting into the wine industry, and I guess I would have thought that would have meant that there wasn't a lot of room left for beer, but then I see breweries popping up all over as well. And Larry Chase, you ever surprised by both of the beverages seemingly on the upswing at the same time?
Not surprised, in part because I think people are really looking for local, and they're looking for flavor. And in terms of the brewing world, up until about 30 years ago, there was really one flavor of beer available in the United States, and it had been that way for a long time. And so with the desire for flavorful things in our lives, the fact that new breweries pop up everywhere, and Americans are always very good at experimentation and developing new things, I think that we certainly have room to grow more.
It's funny you should mention it. I was thinking about 30 years ago, because I think that was about the time that Anheuser-Busch hired Martin Mull to do a campaign for Michelob Classic Dark, I think it was. And the tagline was, "Don't be afraid of the dark." And it seems like a very long time ago
sure.
that people done it if you consider
sure.
dark beers as an option.
Yeah.
Things have changed a lot. We have a question here from, or a call here from Scott in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking beer making with Larry Chase and Gary Glass.
Hi, I'm a former home brewer myself, former because I was diagnosed with celiac disease several years ago and had to go on a gluten-free diet. And at the time, gluten-free beer wasn't commercially available, let alone gluten-free home brewing supplies. But my question is, now that, there has been sort of an evolution of gluten-free beer making on the commercial level, whether there are any home brewing supplies available for people who would want to make gluten-free beer, especially extracts that wouldn't require you to mash your own grains.
All right, let's find out from Gary Glass. Thanks for the question, Scott. Appreciate it.
Sure. Yeah, there definitely is a sorghum syrup is becoming more common amongst homebrew supply shops. If your local shop doesn't have it, you can certainly get it from an online retailer. That would be gluten-free. There's a growing number of other grains that are becoming available. You're looking specifically at extracts, so I'd probably steer you towards that sorghum syrup. There's also a product on the market primarily for clearing beer. I believe it's called Brewer's Clarix. Which has been noted to reduce gluten in beer, and so I know that there have been homebrewers who have been who've made beer for people with celiac that have used that product, that their friends are able to drink their malt beer, malted barley beer, if they use that product. Now, of course, it's going to vary depending on your particular sensitivity to gluten, but that is a potential option for using actually barley-based beer.
Yeah, and I think that Brewer's Clarix is the product that Widmer out of Portland is using to produce their Omission series of gluten-free beers. And Widmer will test their beers every batch under the protocol that is currently available. And I think they generally are falling under 10 parts per million gluten in those products. So the Brewer's Clarix may certainly be something to give a go at.
Are there other grains? You mentioned barley right up at the top, but I recall hearing in years past rice and some other grains can be used as well.
Yeah, rice and corn are also both gluten-free. I believe millet is another one that's been used in some cases. I'm not thoroughly well versed in gluten content of different grains, so mm-hmm. I don't know if Larry has more knowledge on that.
Not a lot. No.
All right. You mentioned testing at Widmer, and it raises a whole other question about the testing of the wares. And I'll get to the homebrew part of this after the break, Gary Glass. But how often do you test it, and how much do you take in a sample to make sure that what you intended to do is what you got?
In terms of the commercial side, our testing primarily result is tasting. That's the way we mostly test.
Yeah, so how do you not get hammered, I guess, is what the question got down to.
Well, you know, I did a couple ounces. I mean, that's enough.
Mm-hmm. Just enough to know. Much more to talk about the brewing of beer, both at the professional and the home levels. Larry Chase is the brewmaster at Standing Stone. Gary Glass, the director of the American Home Brewers Association. AHA will hold a rally at Standing Stone Brewing in Ashland on Sunday, 2 to 5, to allow home brewers to get to meet their pros. And you can join us back here on the Jefferson Exchange with our guests to talk about brewing, back on the Jefferson Exchange, and to talk about beer and your calls and emails in a minute 10. Final segment of today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're learning how to make beer today. No, we're not actually making it here in the studio, but we are getting some tips on what goes on inside the world of beer construction. From two guests, Larry Chase is a brewmaster professional at Standing Stone Brewing Company in Ashland. Gary Glass is the director of the American Home Brewers Association. We love the acronym AHA. AHA will hold a rally at Standing Stone on Sunday, February 22nd, 2 to 5, to get home brewers and professional brewers together to talk shop. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange now at 800-838-3760, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We have an email here from Todd in Ashland, wants to know from Larry how often you brew at Standing Stone, weekly, monthly, and what's the yearly production in barrels?
Yearly production in barrels is about 500 barrels a year, and that a barrel of beer is 31 gallons, equivalent to two full-size kegs. So about 15,000 gallons a year then is our production. And in terms of how often we brew, it really depends on season. Ashland, high tourist season in the summer, and that's when we're the busiest. So we will brew at least a couple batches a week, usually May through September. Right now, the time of year that we're in is about one batch a week, or actually even one batch every 10 or 11 days. Sometimes I don't need to brew, and yet I do to try to keep my yeast healthy and keep that moving along.
Keep the yeast healthy. Explain that.
Well, yeast is a living organism, and the longer that you store yeast, it slowly dies. And so you want to be constantly putting yeast back into a fresh, sugary environment to keep it alive and kicking.
It's essentially eating the sugar, isn't it? I mean, it's
yes.
Digesting it, yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. How long a process does it take? I haven't asked that part of it yet. I'll ask this of homebrewing as well, Gary Glass. But Larry, how long does it take to, from the beginning of the process of making a new beer to having a finished barrel?
Sure. As I mentioned earlier, at Standing Stone, we primarily make ales. Mm-hmm. And since they ferment at a warmer temperature, things go faster and maturation times are quicker. So 2 weeks, really, start to finish. Occasionally, twice a year, we make lagers. Lagers use a yeast that can ferment at a much colder temperature, and at colder temperatures, things take longer. And lager production can be anywhere from probably a 4 to 12 week process.
And for Gary Glass, for home brewers, how long does a process usually take to make a beer?
It's very similar. The fermentation process is going to take if you're brewing an ale, a week to 2 weeks. Is fairly typical for a home brewer, and then aging in bottles to naturally carbonate is going to take another 2 to 3 weeks. So for a typical homebrew batch, it's usually about a month from the time which you brew it to when you're actually enjoying it. stronger beers might take a little bit more aging. And as Larry mentioned, if you're brewing lagers, that's going to take some additional time as well.
You mentioned keeping it in a closet when you were first doing this and didn't bother your roommates too much, particularly because they got to drink the results of the work at the end. Are there any particular odors or messes or things like that that you have to be aware of as you're going through the process of home brewing beer?
Yeah, there are certainly odors involved, especially when you're going through the mashing or boiling process, and I tend to enjoy those aromas. So for me, it's not at all an issue. There is some aroma from fermentation, but it's not terribly strong. So and again, for me, that's a pleasant smell because I know that there's beer at the end of the tunnel.
For a home brewer, what are some of the most common mistakes then, Gary?
With home brewing, the biggest issue is making sure that everything is cleaned and anything that's in the process that touches the beer after the boiling process needs to be sanitized. So the problems come up where you need to put a spoon in something and stir and. If that spoon wasn't sanitized, you could introduce some wild yeast or bacteria that will cause off flavors in the beer. That's probably the biggest issue. There's other and to note, like, there are no known pathogens that can survive in beer. It's acidic. It also has alcohol in it. So you actually can't get anything that will make you sick in the brewing process. But you can introduce things that will make your beer taste bad. So that's the biggest thing is making sure everything is cleaned and sanitized. It's fairly simple, but it's really that mindset of making sure that everything that touches the beer is sanitized.
Larry, you seem to sit up a little taller on this part of the process, and that was one of the first things you said was that you're cleaning things all the time.
When you're in a small brewery and you talk about quality control, quality assurance, for us, it's cleanliness and sanitation. That's where it's at. Because you can go to a lab and test your beer all day long, and then it comes back and tells you that, oh, well, you have this contamination, and what do you have to do? Well, you got to go right back and do what you should have done in the first place, and that's clean and sanitize. So definitely the thing to do, both on the small homebrew scale and in commercial scale, too.
So when we're talking sanitizing, we're talking bleach and water, stuff like that? I mean, is it that level of sanitation needed?
Yeah, we don't use bleach, but because we don't want chlorine in the process, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of other different oxidizing sanitizers out there that we use on the commercial side. You know, Gary can probably speak to home brewers.
Yeah, you're starting to say something there, Gary?
Yeah, so you can certainly use bleach. With bleach, you do have to make sure you're very thorough in cleaning it because there are flavor compounds from bleach that can make it through the brewing process. But there are other specific sanitizers used that don't require rinsing. Idafor or Star San are two of the most common ones, and they're very easily available at local homebrew shops. And those are powerful sanitizers, but they're also safe for use at home. So they work great.
Sounds almost like surgical cleanliness required here.
Probably not quite that level, but
right.
but on the professional side, it's so much more important because there's a huge financial value in that beer. Whereas for a home brewer, if you have something go not quite right and you're brewing 5 gallons, you're really not out much. It's mostly your time that you suffer. But so that's one of the beauties of home brewing is it can be, you don't have to take it too seriously. And even if you do make a mistake, it's really not that big a deal. You'll certainly learn from it.
You operate at a somewhat higher level, Larry Chase.
Yeah, we're definitely very attuned to making sure that cleanliness and sanitation are, we've got protocols, SOPs, in place that have to be followed.
How often do you get inspected and have your equipment checked by various local or state authorities?
Never.
Really?
Because we are an alcohol producer, we are regulated by the Federal Tax and Trade Bureau. And as such, we don't have at this time any oversight regulation from FDA or agricultural regulatory bodies.
So nobody comes in and does a white glove test or anything to make sure the equipment's clean?
No.
Really?
And I think that goes back to what Gary said earlier, is that there are no known pathogens in beer because of its acidity, because of the alcohol content, that are going to cause death or sickness to people. All it does is make your beer taste bad. And that's more of a financial issue to the brewery than anything else.
Absolutely. We're talking beer making again with Larry Chase, the brewmaster at Standing Stone, and Gary Glass, the director of the American Homebrewers Association. Another email for Larry from Todd in Ashland, wondering if you ever sell or make available your yeast to homebrewers.
So if I say it over the air, will I get a 100 people coming for yeast?
You'll probably see a lot more people on Sunday this week.
Well, we certainly always have an extra amount of yeast. And occasionally I have had homebrewers come by. And you know, all a homebrewer needs is, I mean, even a pint jar of yeast is probably way more than they need for a batch. And I'm usually pretty willing to hand off a pint jar of yeast.
So is yeast proprietary? I mean, you have to buy it yourself from someplace to start with, right? And then does it just continue to grow? It is bacteria, right?
Sure. It depends. Now, there certainly are some breweries that probably have their own proprietary yeast that they've developed over generations, and they've got the lab facilities to be able to handle that and keep it going. At Standing Stone, we will purchase yeast from a commercial yeast company that is doing that instead. So it's not a proprietary yeast. But when we purchase a fresh batch, we can repitch that yeast through 10, 15 generations of batches of beer until it's probably time to get a new batch of yeast again.
You were talking earlier about making mostly ales at Standing Stone. I mentioned that a couple times. And I'm curious to know what makes the difference then. And let me direct this to you, Gary Glass, for the folks who might be wanting to make stuff at home. The difference, first of all, between ales and lagers and stouts, for example, and then what the tweaking is in the process to make them come out.
I'll start with the ales versus lagers. It's two different strains of yeast. Ales, as Larry said, ferment at warmer temperatures. Mm-hmm. They produce more more esters, which give fruity character to the beer. Whereas lagers are fermented at colder temperatures, usually mid 50s down to upper 40s, and those beers, they take a little bit longer to brew. The yeast isn't as active at that temperature, but it produces a much cleaner beer. You don't get those fruity notes. But you can brew a huge array of beers with both with either lager or ale yeast. You mentioned stout. Stout's commonly it's an ale, so you would be using an ale yeast. The difference between, say, a stout and maybe like a pale ale is going to be the malt that you use. So with a stout, you would use some roasted grains. You can use something called like black patent, roasted barley, chocolate malts, different caramel malts are going to produce that dark color and the roasted flavor in a stout.
Is there anything more tricky to the process, Larry Chase, as you make those things? Just a difference in ingredients?
Yeah, it's a difference in ingredients and a difference in process, temperature being one of the key components of that.
So, and I've seen other, I mean, we just talked about the chocolate, and I have seen chocolate porters and espresso stouts and stuff like that. I mean, we're using actual coffee beans in there, or what's the process that makes a flavor like that?
Well, you can't, probably definitely yes when you see the espresso stouts, the chocolate stouts, or beers with that. At Standing Stone, we have Noble Stout, which we add in a cold brewed coffee concentrate that helps accent that coffee flavor. Now, some of those roasted malts that we use also give off some coffee and chocolate-like flavors, but you can enhance that. Chocolate beers will use chocolate nibs, cacao nibs that they put into the beer to help get some of that chocolate flavor in there. And that's one thing that home brewers are fabulous at, is the experimentation of adding all of these other ingredients for flavor besides the basic four.
Which I was going to head to you next anyway, Gary Glass, because I was going to ask how exotic some of the things that you have seen and heard over the years in getting to know home brewing.
You just about anything you can imagine has been thrown into beer at some point by homebrewers. You know, we talked about 30 years ago and what beer was like back then as opposed to now. You know, you went from a single type of beer, American light lager, to now there's just a huge array of beers available. And that is directly attributable to the homebrewing culture that we have here in the United States, where people are free to experiment at home and adding in different ingredients. You know, I've had beers made with Thai curry, any fruit you could possibly imagine, wide variety of different spices, experimentation with you know, coffee and different beers. Yeah, just about anything you can think of, you can put into beer. And the beauty of homebrewing is that, you know, you can experiment, and sometimes those experiments don't come out that great, but you'll learn something every time you do that, and then you the next time around, you will make something that's great.
Was there ever anything that the idea of it made you make a face, but then you sipped it and went, oh, this is okay?
Yeah, several things. So, you know, that I was very nervous about that Thai, I believe it was Thai chili stout or curry stout, that I had at one of our homebrewers conferences, and actually a brewer from Oregon that's been making a beer with mushrooms, which I thought sounded terrible, but it actually worked really well. So, you can experiment and figure out ways to make flavors work with beer just about any way imaginable.
All kinds of fun to be had in homebrewing. The American Homebrewers Association hosts a rally at Standing Stone this Sunday, 2 to 5. Larry Chase is the brewmaster at Standing Stone. Gary Glass is the director of the American Homebrewers Association. Thank you both so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Our pleasure.
Yeah, thank you for having us.